From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, Rashad Robinson, Executive Director of Color of Change, and journalist Sonali Kohatkar discuss how communities on the ground are reacting to Donald Trump's election win. And actress Naomi Harris talks about her role in the critically acclaimed new movie Moonlight. But first, will the president-elect Donald Trump heal the wounds caused by a race that was mired in controversy, from sexual harassment allegations against him to investigations by the FBI into Hillary Clinton's emails? And what will his priorities be on day one? Joining me now to unpack all of this, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Thomas Friedman, also a columnist, of course, for The New York Times. His latest text, out in just days, is called Thank You for Being Late, an optimist guide to thriving in the age of accelerations. Thomas Friedman, good to have you back on this program, sir.
Tavis, thanks for having me.
Let me jump right in. To your mind, what happened?
Well, what happened, was an earthquake. You can't underestimate it, Tavis. And whenever you get as big a shift in the tectonic plates as you got with the election of Donald Trump as president, you know it was fed by many things. The factors that I would identify would be the following. One is, a profound sense of homelessness that a lot of Americans feel. And this is something I do discuss in my book for a couple of reasons. One is a feeling that their communities are being overwhelmed by people of a different color and a different culture.
Mm-hmm.
And you're seeing a backlash to that. I go to the grocery store and somebody's speaking Spanish or is wearing a head cover. That's one, trend that was part of this. The second is a sense of homelessness that comes from, I'm working in an office, there's now a robot threatening my job, there's now software that's eating away at another part of it. And a sense that the two things that anchor you in the world, your community and your workplace, are somehow in play. So I think the sort of the best of the Trump backlash was about that. It was something profound. The worst of it, was what Van Jones on CNN called a white lash, a backlash against 8 years of our first African-American president. And I think that ugliness was also part of it. And I think another part of it, Tavis, honestly, is just a kind of debasement of our culture, a fascination with a TV personality, someone who lives the life of the rich and famous, that was also an allure to people. And also, I think there was an element of, what the hell? What do we have to lose? Let's shake up the game board. These guys haven't done so well. So even though Trump has said and done all of these noxious things, let's give it a ride. And so you put all of those things together, and somewhere in there you got a slim majority of electoral votes for Donald Trump as president.
So there's a lot to unpack there. So let me start where you began, Thomas, and that is with the first part of your part A of your definition of homelessness. As I heard it, that could also be described by some as nativism or worse yet, racism. Why call it homelessness as opposed to nativism or racism?
Sure, and I'd be happy to, and I make that point in my book. I think you're seeing this backlash to immigrants and to people of different color and faiths being all mixed together now in this age of globalization. You saw it. It was a big part of Brexit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that kind of nativist, racist, put whatever, is label on it you want, was at work here in this election as well. And there are a lot of, we know, white males, less educated, who feel threatened by this influx of people who look different from them, mm-hmm. and who feel threatened by these changes in the workplace. And Donald Trump vowed to build a wall to stop all these changes. And they were more than happy to sign up, for that parade, no matter how noxious or indecent his personality. And if you ask me what is so shocking to me, just as a citizen, not just as a journalist, it's that so many people were ready to overlook so much of his baggage, his personal baggage, things mm-hmm. he's done, his basic indecency in many ways, in order to make that vote. It was shocking to me.
I'll come back to the homeland, Thomas, in just a second. But since no one at the New York Times or anyplace else, for that matter, writes about this better than you do, and since you mentioned Brexit, as you well know, this is not what happened. It's not just happening in this country. It's happening around the globe. Unpack for me why that is the case.
It's a very good question, Tavis. And it's, again, something I try to explain in my book. We're in an age of accelerated globalization. Because barriers have come down between countries voluntarily in some cases, in the case of the EU, in the case of NAFTA in the United States, we have simply more people mixing and meeting with more other people and on the move. But at the same time, Tavis, because of the rising disorder in parts of the world, mm-hmm. in the case of Europe, in the Middle East and North Africa, in the case of our hemisphere from Central and Latin America, people flowing in, and refugees from abroad, but those are more controlled immigration because they have to cross the ocean. You have just a lot more people on the move today. We actually have more refugees today than any time since World War II. Some are climate refugees, some are war refugees. And so you have just a lot more people confronting the other. And this clearly is happening at a pace that and a scope that is too fast for some people. And you saw the first backlash to that in Europe. And their electoral map in the UK with their dropping out of the European Union, their electoral map looks so much like ours. That is in all of the urban centers where young people predominate, who actually like a more multicultural, embrace that kind of diversity society. They all voted to stay in the European Union. In America, they voted for Hillary Clinton. And then outside these urban areas, less cosmopolitan, mm-hmm. More nativist oriented, less welcoming of the other, and they voted for Trump and for Brexit.
And less educated.
And less educated as well.
Yeah. So you know that after the Brexit vote, I read your stuff all the time, of course, you know that after the Brexit vote, there was a huge national rethinking of that vote. As you recall, everybody was Googling Brexit to see what, in fact, they had voted for. I'm not sure that I see the signs of that already in this country, but might it be the case in the next days and weeks that we will rethink what we did here by electing Donald Trump?
You know, that so much depends on, obviously, on what Trump does. You know, what I said in my own column, which I wrote after he was declared the victor, is that if you're looking for a silver lining, there's one silver lining with Donald Trump. I don't think he believes a single thing he said during this campaign.
Yeah.
That's not to say I think he's really a dove and a liberal in wolf's clothing, but you know what I'm saying.
Sure.
And therefore, he can change on a dime. He could say about Mexico, I didn't mean a wall. I meant a virtual wall. I was actually meant Wall Street in Mexico. Oh, you heard wall? I mean, this guy could just change on a dime.
Yeah.
I think he's also, again, if you're looking for a silver lining, this is a guy who wants to win and he wants to succeed. Okay, you know, the dog caught the car, and I'm not comparing him to a dog, but you know what I mean? The story of the dog, you know, chasing the car. So he caught the car, and now he's sitting on the hood, and he wants to succeed. And because of that, you'd think he will want to appoint good people, and he'll want to proceed with some caution. And so I think he's going to be very, very unpredictable.
Yeah.
I mean, what I tell people, I just have three questions after this election. Question number one is, who is Donald Trump?
Right.
Is he the racist, xenophobe, woman assaulting guy we saw some days? Or is he the guy who gave that speech saying we all have to come together? You know, who's Donald Trump? Who's the Republican Party?
Mm-hmm.
Is it Paul Ryan's Republican Party of kind of Wall Street Republicans want free trade, immigration, entitlement reform? Or is it, a Breitbart alt-right party, which wants God knows what, you know? At the same time, who are the Democrats now? They have to really decide who are they. So they're, and I think all of these questions and their answers will affect one another.
Yeah.
And so I'm just keeping my powder dry. You know, my position is I will not do what Republicans did the last 8 years, which is from day one try to make the first African-American president in our history fail.
Right.
And they did that for 8 years. And we paid a price for it. By the way, they paid a price for it because they so left their garden untended, they got an invasive species called Donald Trump, who took it over.
Yeah.
So it wasn't without cost to them. But I'm not going to sit here and plot to make Trump fail. But I know what I believe. I know what I believe is good for the country, and I'm going to stand for those values. If they overlap with the direction he takes us, I'll support him. If they don't, I will remain a critic and a skeptic.
Before I get to HRC, Donald Trump sees himself as a winner. He wants to win in business. He wants to win in life. He sees himself as a winner. I don't know that he wanted to be president initially, but when he got wind that he could win, right, the guy dug in his heels because he wanted to win. He is a winner. The question I have now is, now that he's won, once he won the nomination, now he's won the presidency, what does winning look like for him as president? If the guy is a winner and wants to win, which is to say he wants to be a successful president, how do we know what winning means for Donald Trump in the governing and not the campaigning? Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. And I took this up a little bit last night because Trump comes out of a real estate tradition. So in real estate, everything is zero sum. I win, that means you lose.
Right.
Okay. In fact, the more you lose, the more I win. That does not apply to America and the world. Okay. In real estate, it's win-lose. With us in the world and in an interdependent world, most of the time, it has to be win-win. Yes,
right.
In the Cold War, we wanted to win and they wanted to lose. But, you know, after World War II, we did the Marshall Plan. We actually gave Europe money, okay, mm-hmm. to build them up into a healthy, democratic, a free market economy that became an incredible partner for us, trading partner and democracy promoting partner that made us both stronger, more stable and wealthy. So a lot of what we do in the world is win-win. And Trump comes along and he basically, you know, saying to the Koreans, like it's a real estate deal. Hey, Korea, your dim sum restaurant's not paying its fair share rent. You know, you're going to have to pony up, pal. Well, you know what happens when you say that to the Koreans? And then he says to the Japanese, yeah, your sushi place, you know, in my tower isn't. No, this is not a real estate deal. Because when you tell the Japanese and the Koreans, if you don't pay a little bit more, we're gonna drop you. You know what they say? Oh, very interesting. Then we're gonna go get our own nuclear weapon because we got China next door, and suddenly you have massive nuclear proliferation. So these things, he has not thought these things out at all. And the second point I would say is this, Tavis. You know, the premise of my book is that what's shaping the world today is that we're in the middle of three giant exponential accelerations in what I call the market, Mother Nature, and Moore's Law.
Mm-hmm.
Moore's Law is a proxy for a technology that the speed and power of microchips will double every 24 months. So if you put it on a graph, it looks like a hockey stick. Mother Nature, that's climate change, biodiversity loss, population. Put it on a graph, it looks like a hockey stick. And the market for me is digital globalization. Put it on a graph, it looks like a hockey stick. We're in the middle, Tavis, not of one. We're in the middle of three climate changes at once. And they are not just changing the world. They are reshaping it. And I tell a story, I quote a congressman from Minnesota where I grew up as saying, you know, if you grew up in Minnesota in the 60s and 70s, in the 60s and 70s in Minnesota, you needed a plan to fail. You needed a plan to fail. That is, there was so much wind at our back then that if you just had an average education and average skills, the system, the updraft was so powerful, it would take you forward to the American dream. Today, Tavis, in this age of acceleration,
mm-hmm.
you need a plan to succeed. You need a plan to succeed as a country. You need a plan to succeed as a company. And most of all, every individual worker needs a plan to succeed. Mm-hmm. Therefore, leadership, it always mattered, Tavis. It matters more than ever today at the national level and at the personal level.
Yeah.
And that's what's going to be, I think, a big challenge for Trump. This is not your grandfather's world.
In case you're just tuning in, we're talking to Thomas Friedman of the New York Times. His new book is called Thank You for Being Late, An Optimist's Guide to Thriving in the Age of Accelerations. That's the text to which he just referenced. Speaking of the book and of your point about needing a plan to succeed, how worried are you about the fact that if Trump does have a plan, he was able to get away with winning the nomination and winning the election without really detailing much of whatever it might be?
Well, you know, I that's what terrifies me, that I have no idea how much of this world he really understands. He's shown no interest in doing his homework. But let me just sort of address, you know, the challenges of these three accelerations, and I say globalization and technology and in the climate. I think there's only one way to go forward. And that is, we need to get, and this is my own personal politics, but I frame this in the book, that is, my personal politics, Tavis, is I'm actually on some issues, I am to the left of Bernie Sanders. I believe we should have single-payer healthcare system. Mm-hmm. I believe that as the world gets this fast, we need to strengthen all of our safety nets. And we need to enable and empower and inspire every American to do lifelong learning. Because the new social contract is that you can have a lifelong job, but only if you are a lifelong learner. So on some issues, I'm to the left of Bernie. But on other issues, quite frankly, I'm to the right of the Wall Street Journal editorial page.
That is, That's hard to do, Thomas.
Exactly, because there isn't a lot of room there, but I found a little sliver. And that is, I'm for eliminating all corporate taxes and replacing them with a carbon tax, a tax on sugar, a tax on bullets, and a small financial transaction tax. I want to get radically entrepreneurial over here to unleash everyone's economic potential to pay for the safety nets I think we're going to need over here as the world becomes too fast for some people, and I don't want to leave them behind. We saw already in this election just the potential of what can happen when we do that. And so my own politics is very hybrid. And the one, if I have, again, a glimmer, I mean, and it needs a microscope for me to find the glimmer of hope in Trump, it's that, again, he's so unmoored politically, mm-hmm. you know, that he could stumble his way toward that kind of combination. Because one thing he has said is he's not for cutting Social Security. And so I think that's where politics is going to have to go ultimately. And that brings together, I think, ultimately both the center left and the center right.
Yeah.
Whether Trump gets there, again, I have no idea, but that's where I want to go. And that's what I'm trying to promote in this book.
To my mind, and I'm curious to get your take on this, Thomas, to my mind, the Democrats put up an elitist candidate mm-hmm. in a populist election. It really is that simple to me. Now, there are a number of tentacles that come off of that, and you've talked about some of those issues tonight. But I think fundamentally, Hillary had bad timing in 2008 coming off of Bush. She'd voted for the Iraq War, and Obama beat her over the head with that. Bad timing in 2008, bad timing this time because, again, the Democrats put up an elitist candidate in a populist election, and I think that explains what happened last night.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was so much stuff going on, and whenever you talk about the Clintons, there's just so much other baggage, you know. You know, when I decided yesterday, I mean, as I said, you know, from the beginning of this election, Tavis, I was totally, took Trump seriously. I was never one of those people who said he'll be gone by June or July or August. I took him seriously. And to the very last day, and though I was highly critical of him, I tried to speak to Trump voters with respect, even if I totally disagreed with them. I knew Clinton was going to lose, or I had a bad feeling she was going to lose, when I cast my vote, and I did it with so little enthusiasm.
And why? And why? What brought you such misery?
I just never felt she had that combination that I think of center left. Far left and center right ideas that I think we're going to need as we go forward. Mm-hmm. I think maybe in her heart she had them, but she never really excited people with, I have a plan that can both take care of the people who are going to be left behind here and at the same time unleash the economy in ways we're going to need in order to afford this. And I think you have to have the balance. That's where my politics is.
I'm not one that believes that an election hangs on a particular word or a particular incident per se, but I do believe, Thomas, that comment of her referring to his supporters as deplorables,
totally.
They're gonna be unpacking that one word for years to come. You agree?
You know, Tavis, I learned, I'm a little Jewish guy from Minnesota who's covered the Arab world for, 40 years. And I'm, people read my stuff there. Now, how did that happen, what did I learn coming from that background and covering the Arab Muslim world for so long, and not doing it in a way by saying, you're all wonderful, you're all great, it's all the Jews' fault,
Mm-hmm.
The biggest lesson I've ever learned in journalism and life is that the secret to journalism is being a good listener.
Mm-hmm.
Not only, and not even most importantly, because of what you learn when you listen, but actually more importantly, because listening is a sign of respect. Mm-hmm. And if I go into a classroom of young Arab Muslim students, and sometimes, boy, they've got columns of mine printed out and they're ready to carve me up, you know, and you just spend an hour listening to them. And I mean deep listening, not just waiting for them to stop talking. Mm-hmm. It's amazing what they will let you say back. If people sense that you are listening to them, that you basically want them to succeed, you can actually tell them anything.
That's right.
But if they sense you're not listening, that you really couldn't care less if they succeed or not, you're there to deliver your speech and then get out, you can't tell them that the sun is shining. And listening is a sign of respect. And when people sense that you respect them at that kind of heart level, you know, there's a famous Talmudic phrase, what comes from the heart enters the heart.
That's right.
What doesn't come from the heart doesn't enter the heart. And when people sense that, wow, you can take them places. They will listen to you. But if you sit down and say, look, half of you are okay in distress. The other half of you, you're deplorable. But I can't tell you who's in which half.
Yeah.
You all figure it out. That is just so stupid. And it's just so counterproductive. Because if you want your message to receive in the heart, it's got to come from the heart. And it's got to start with giving people a sense of dignity.
Yeah. What say you to all those persons who are licking their wounds and can't believe that this America is their country?
Well, first of all, I want to affirm their feelings. I know how they feel. I share so many of them. And my daughter, you know, called me really distressed, you know, because of this. And, you know, I try to tell her, look, Sonny, I have to tell you honestly, when Reagan was elected, I had some of those feelings. When George W. Bush was elected and then reelected, I had some of those feelings. But this country is incredibly strong, and we've been through hard patches before, and you know, I really believe that this is an amazing time. That's why my book is called An Optimist's Guide to Thriving in the Age of Acceleration, because I do believe if you want to make something today, it's an amazing time, but it's also an incredibly challenging time. You know, my book, Tavis, has a theme song. It's actually by Brandi Carlile. It's called The I-E-Y-E. And the main refrain is, I wrapped your love around me like a chain, but I never was afraid that it would die. You can dance in a hurricane as long as you're standing in the eye. And it seems to me that Donald Trump ran on, I can stop the hurricane. I don't think you can do that. I think you need to build an eye that moves with these forces of change, draws energy from them, but at the same time provides a platform of dynamic stability within them. And where I see optimism in the country, those platforms of dynamic stability, they are healthy communities. If you want to be an optimist about America, Tavis, stand on your head, because this country looks so much better from the bottom up than the top down. And I see healthy communities, or I see communities applying hope. Okay, I have a friend, Amory Lovins, who likes to say, are you an optimist or a pessimist? He always says, I'm neither, because they're just two forms of fatalism. All right, everything's going to be great. Everything's going to be awful. And Amory says, I believe in applied hope. Well, I've seen a lot of applied hope at the community level all over this country. All right, and people just coming together, black, white, all kinds of colors, all kinds of faith, all kinds of genders, and they're solving problems together. And this is not just blowing smoke.
Sure.
This is happening. In fact, it's one of the reasons we're going forward. There's a lot of people applying hope to building the eye in the hurricane. And that's what you should do. Don't get focused on Washington. Don't get depressed by that. Find that eye in your community, build it, contribute to it. That is what will and continue to make America great.
And there you have it. From Thomas Friedman. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. As we all well know, this campaign for the White House revealed divisions. It also heightened tensions between people of different races, cultures, and classes. So, what steps are social justice advocates taking now to create new ways for all Americans to work together and to address the disaffection of so many? Rashad Robinson is executive director of the civil rights group Color of Change, and Sonali Kohatkar is a columnist for Truth Dig. She's also the radio host of the show Rising Up with Sonali. Let me start by asking you first, Sonali. Did you accept the spirit, the words that he offered in that acceptance speech?
No, because he's been very, very severely managed in the last week or so. They've taken away his megaphone and his
Twitter
freedom to say whatever he wants to say, which may be why he squeezed out a win in the last few days. But everything's been managed. He was reading off of a teleprompter. Mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure what to make of that speech. He didn't come out and repeat the claims about banning Muslims, building a wall, etc. But he said them. They're there. Yeah. And now, you know, he and his voters, his supporters, have to own that and sort of face the rest of the country, us. Yeah. So, no, I didn't buy it. And it was actually very surreal to me.
Yeah.
I don't think he's expected to win.
Yeah.
I think he thought he could use this whole election as a jumping off point to build out his media empire, be able to say they rigged the election, and all of a sudden he's won and he's just kind of deer caught in the headlights.
Did you buy it?
No, well, he didn't say anything different.
Yeah.
So it wasn't that he pushed back or said that I don't believe those things anymore.
Yeah.
Those things are still there, and he didn't talk policy.
Yeah.
He simply talked about how he wants to bring the country together, but still bring the country together under his leadership, under the platform in which he ran on. And the fact of the matter is that Donald Trump stirred up a whole new set of voters, a whole set of voters that have not voted traditionally in elections, is that's what we're seeing. And the fact of the matter is people are going to want something for their participation. They're going to want to make good on their participation. He's going to have to deliver on something for those folks who turned out. And so the fact of the matter is unless we hear Donald Trump say that he no longer believes those things, we have to believe that he's going into office to represent the people that got him there.
So in other words, what I think I hear you saying is that the good white folk who elected Donald Trump are not going to let him off the hook the way the good black folk let Barack Obama off the hook.
Yeah, and I think, and it was not just the good black folks that let Barack Obama off the hook. The larger progressive community, think, consistently let Barack Obama off the hook. And it's not just Barack Obama. It's the full Democratic establishment that continues to run elections over and over again, that can talk about democracy, can talk about the economy, and can somehow leave race out of it and think that if they don't talk about race, it's not going to come up. What Donald Trump taught us is that the right will talk about race. They will talk about race over and over again, and they will get results for it.
The question that you're raising is very legitimate to me, which is what do we do with the racism and the sexism and the classism? Because if he won, those things won too. In a very real way, those things were given the RNC stamp of approval. So if he doesn't apologize, if he doesn't backtrack, which he won't, what do we do with the racism and the sexism and the classism that we felt so stung by?
Right, and I think we essentially, through the election of Donald Trump, have to face the fact that we've had a war waged against us. This is a declaration of war that so many millions of Americans, you know, almost an even split, Hillary won the popular vote, but just by a tiny amount of the electorate, almost an even split, was able to say, we're going to back this candidate who said all of these things. And some of them said, we don't really believe all of these things. Mm-hmm. What we want is a candidate of change. That's what he promised. I want to hear from a Donald Trump voter, and that's really who I want to sit down and talk to at this moment, particularly an educated Donald Trump voter, maybe even a female educated Donald Trump voter, and ask her to explain to me whether she's going to take a strong position against all the racism, sexism, etc., that maybe she believes he didn't really mean. And if she says, I will take a strong stand, then I can say to her, you and I have common ground to work for economic justice together. But unless you denounce what he said, we're at opposite sides.
What do you make of the fact that so many women in the final analysis did vote for him?
45% educated women.
How do you explain that?
I think that it is sadly an issue of, the issues of race and economy are intertwined. You can explain away college, whites without a college education, they're suffering. Women, I think white women who've been the greatest beneficiaries of affirmative action still see, you know, I think of that University of Texas woman who sued because she didn't get in to the University of Texas, who see people of color as still taking their jobs away from us, meaning whites, taking benefits away, sucking all of these things up, and that white racial resentment came into play.
And I think this is where the left oftentimes gets into trouble because once again, we talk about economy and we think we're all saying the same thing, mm-hmm. that the economy's doing well. But Donald Trump tapped into something different, this whole idea of make America great again. Mm-hmm. And we can say it's about economy, but it's actually trying to take us back to what was a simpler time when people didn't have to sort of think twice about what they said in the mm-hmm. office place because they weren't going to offend someone. Mm-hmm. That they, like, everyone sort of looked like them, and then they turned on the TV, they sort of understood what people were saying, and they understood all the music. You know, the fact of the matter is that I don't know who the we is, and I think mm-hmm. that's going to be the real question moving forward. As I talk to white progressives, mm-hmm. White folks of good faith who ran movements of, you know, standing up against hate, mm-hmm. pushing back against hate, the question is what will they be doing on Thanksgiving and Christmas? Will they have the conversations with their Aunt mm-hmm. Edna? Because this is not necessarily conversations that black and brown people mm-hmm. can effectively lead. Black women turned out higher for Hillary than they did for Obama in 2012. The fact of the matter is that Hillary lost white women. And so that speaks to sort of the changing way that people are sort of experiencing the fault lines in this country and the need for white people of good faith to organize other white people.
But if people surrender their agency to be outraged by the insult that comes out of the mouth of the candidate, then how do you ever stop it? How do you ever check it?
I think it's an outrage, obviously, and we've fought back against it. But the fact of the matter is that the Democratic Party is only relying on the toxicity yeah. of the Republicans as the fuel to turn people out.
Right, right, right.
When people have to go in the booth and make choices, after 8 years of one administration, over and over again, everything has told us that people will choose change in the next election. Mm. And so we knew going into this election that this was a change
election. But this is not just, my point, let me press this again, though. This is not just, Rashad's right,
yeah.
but this is not just change to me. I'm not a pacifist, although yeah. I'm a huge student of Dr. King. If you slap me, I will slap you
yeah.
back.
Yeah.
Let me be clear about this.
Yeah.
So that if you're going to talk about me like a dog,
yeah.
you can't expect to receive my vote. And my point is, if women vote for him anyway, if Hispanics at the level they did vote for him anyway, I don't know what the answer is.
I think a lot of people did sit this election out. Among certain groups, voter turnout wasn't as high enough. And I think, to Rashad's point, it's really important. This was an election about the status quo versus change. Not the kind of change we want.
Sure, sure, sure.
But, you know, all Hillary Clinton had to offer was that she wasn't Donald Trump. It wasn't enough.
How much
the sane candidate and he's the insane one, wasn't enough.
To your point, Sonali, how much of the outcome has to do, to your mind, with the fact that the Democrats just put up the wrong elitist candidate mm-hmm. in a populist oh, yeah. election?
Absolutely. I mean, Bernie Sanders proved during the primary yeah. election that you can take the Democratic Party left and it will energize new people to come mm-hmm. into the party, which the party desperately needs, and that going right isn't the way to go, which is what the Clintons did mm-hmm. and have been trying to do. Mm-hmm. Going left is the way to go because a whole bunch of us are out here going, we need to see somebody echoing our values, not just in lip service, but in actual action. Mm-hmm. Who is actually running for the White House? They didn't take that lesson. They called him a doofus,
yeah.
you know, in those emails. They yeah. belittled him.
Yeah. So you first, Rashad, I think this is the extra question. Whether you like him or loathe him, whether you hate him or love him, he is our president now. Uh-huh. So what do we do? What do we do for the next four years?
So we can't pretend like we're defeated,
right.
but we have to understand this. We were defeated in this election, but we are not defeated as a movement.
Yeah.
And we have to step back and think about the strategies moving forward to fight back and push back against the things, but also think about how are we rebuilding in a new way. You know, To the point that Sonali made around Bernie Sanders, whether or not he was the right ambassador for that mm-hmm. message or not, the idea of the establishment continuing to do the same things over and over again and expecting different results mm-hmm. is stupid
yeah.
and should be put to rest.
Yeah.
What we actually need is a new aspirational politics that puts out real issues and brings people in, that also builds infrastructure in black and brown communities to speak for themselves and to build, but also has real conversations with white communities that white organizations are running and leading. And I think we've also got to do the work over the next 4 years to figure out how are we going to deal with voter suppression laws that are only going to get worse.
Yeah.
They're going to continue to keep people from the polls and it can continue to make it harder. And the Democrats that are in office, This election cycle, one of the silver linings was the district attorney races all around the country, where many in the movement for Black Lives worked to translate the presence of criminal justice and the presence of policing into the power to change many of the rules around how district attorneys work by kicking out some bad district attorneys in Cook County and Harris County. The question is what will Democrats be able to run on in the future? Will it be more promises or will it be actual results?
Yeah, what do we do, Sanaa?
And I think white liberals with power who wished Hillary Clinton could have been president and realized that just wishing it, wanting it really hard was not enough. That is a group that needs to stop and think about where they can invest their power and resources in doing something different. Mm-hmm. We need for communities of color to have better representation. We need to rebuild our movements to reflect the America that Donald Trump wishes away and his electorate is trying to wish away. And we have to remind them, we're not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. You can't wish us away. We deserve the same things that you think you deserve and you think we're stealing from you, but we're simply, you know, basically taking and working hard for what we deserve and what you also may deserve, but let's do this together. In the end, when climate change comes to bite us, it's going to impact us all. I do want us to see how we can find ways to build bridges with those Donald Trump voters who might say, okay, I didn't agree with all his racism and sexism, I just voted for him because he's a candidate of change. Mm-hmm. We can't survive this unless we find a way to build something together.
We agree on that. Sanaa, Rashad, good to have you both on.
Great to be
here. Thanks for
your
keen insights. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. British actress Naomi Harris is best known for her work in movies like Skyfall, Spectre, and the horror flick 28 Days Later. In her latest role, she plays the troubled mother of a boy coming of age in the deeply moving film Moonlight. The project looks set to be the breakout movie of the year. Naomi Harris is here now to talk about what drew her to the project. Before we start our conversation with Naomi, first a clip from the film Moonlight.
What happened? Huh? What happened, Chiron? Why you didn't come home like you're supposed to? Huh? And who is you?
Nobody. I found him yesterday. Found him in a hole on 15th. Yeah, that one. Some boys chased him in the cut. He's scared more than anything. Wouldn't tell me where he lived till this morning.
Well, thanks for seeing to him. He usually can take care of himself. Be good that way, but...
Everybody is talking about this, and everybody loves it. What is it that you think or hope that people are connecting to in the story?
I think the universality of it. You know, it's really about the fact that when you strip back the layers and all the labels that society wants to put on us and that we want to put on ourselves, ultimately we're all the same. We're all searching for love and connection. And I think that's why people really connect with the movie, because they see themselves reflected on screens, even though the story is incredibly specific.
Yeah. What do you make of the fact that people connect to the humanity in a film that has African American or African artist in it? And I raise that because it just seems to me that sometimes in this business that the complexity of our humanity isn't always placed on screen. So when you have a film that tells the story that this film tells, and that people, no matter their color, see it and they connect to that very point, the humanity, then I think something's been accomplished in that regard.
Exactly. Yeah. I really believe that it has. And I think what's wonderful about the film also is that, you know, so many of the stereotypes that we normally see represented on screen and the normal way that we see Black people represented are smashed. And we see fully three-dimensional, fully fleshed out characters. And that's a real testament to the writer, Terrell McCraney, and also to the director, Barry Jenkins.
Yeah. Tell me about those three-dimensional characters. When you saw the script, when it came across your desk, what did you see in this that helped you decide that you wanted to do it? And I asked that because I read something that you can tell me if I'm wrong about this. And if I am, disabuse me. Don't slap me, but just disabuse me of the notion.
Slap you.
Okay, don't slap me yet if I'm wrong. But I read somewhere where you swore to never play a character like this.
I did.
So you saw, yes. Obviously you saw something that convinced you otherwise. So mm-hmm. tell me what the process was when you saw the screenplay.
So when I read it, I was just moved emotionally. I just, it made me cry. You know, it made me cry several times. Mm-hmm. And I just deeply connected with it, even though it's a world that's alien to mine. You know, I didn't grow up in Liberty City in Miami. I'm British. But again, it was that universal message within it that really connected and moved me. And I just thought, it's such a beautiful script. It has to be told.
What was it about this character specifically that you wanted to connect to, or wanted us to connect to?
I really did not want to connect with the character of Paula, to be quite honest with you. I really had issues about playing a crack addict because, you know, my mum is a shining example for me. She's always been my role model to me because she's such a strong, powerful, intelligent, capable woman. And I don't see enough of those women represented on screen. Mm-hmm. So I always thought, you know, as an actor, I don't have very much power. Mm-hmm. But the place where I do have power is in my choices. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to make sure that my choices reflect positive images of black women. And then I get this crack addict role. And so there was a lot of resistance within me. But what really changed my mind was speaking to Barry Jenkins, our director, and he explained that he wanted to tell his story. And his story necessarily involved that of his mother. And his mother was a crack addict. So I thought, here for the first time is someone who's emotionally invested in ensuring that this character has the full complexity and the full humanity that she deserves. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so that's why I wanted to be part of
this. This is one of those inside the actor studio kinds of questions, but let me ask anyway. How does an actor connect to a character that admittedly they don't want to play in the first place?
Yeah.
And the character itself is an anathema to anything they hold dear. Mm-hmm. As an actor, how do you do the 180? How do you make that happen?
So in the beginning, it's difficult because you said yes to something and you're not sure how you're going to reach it. And it's scary. I really was terrified that I wasn't going to be able to achieve this, especially because also I don't drink alcohol.
Yeah.
I don't smoke. Yeah. I don't even drink coffee. I miss clean living. So Paula, for me, to play a crack addict is like a massive leap. And I think
coffee's like crack for some people. I work with someone every day.
I stay away from it.
That's another conversation for another time for all my coffee drinking friends. But anyway, I'm sorry, I digress. Yeah.
So, you know, she scared me. Yeah. And I think that the interesting thing for me was that I had to learn that I was standing in judgment of her. Mm-hmm. I was standing in judgment of her addiction. Yeah. I couldn't get my head around it. And it wasn't until I stopped judging her and I just had allowed myself to really have compassion for her journey that she revealed herself to me and that she came out of the recesses of my imagination.
Yeah. How do you research for a character like this?
YouTube.
Yeah.
YouTube is like an incredible mine of information. It has everything that you could possibly want on there because, you know, you have amazing people who go around with their iPhones and go to places that you would never go to, like crack dens, and interview crack addicts. And, you know, you have all of that there. You also have incredible documentaries on crack addiction, interviews with crack addicts. You have everything you could possibly want. And also, documentaries about Miami in the 1980s because, of course, culturally it's dissimilar to me, so I had to really research and get my head around that as well.
Yeah. What did you find socially redemptive about the character? Because, again, you had to see her in the fullness of who she was. What did you find to be redemptive about her?
So what I found very, very interesting from doing my research was that every single one of the women who were crack addicts had been raped or sexually abused as children. Mm-hmm. And that for me was the main in to understanding and having compassion for Paula. Because what I realized is no woman is ever raped once. No child is ever sexually abused once because it's replayed in their minds 100 times or more a day and throughout their lifetime. Mm-hmm. So what happens without the right therapy and help, it becomes a living torment to live in your mind and body. And under those circumstances, who can blame someone for wanting reaching out to something to numb their pain? And that's what Paula's doing. She's crying out really for help and for a way of dealing with this pain, this emotional well that she has inside of her, because she's had such a traumatic childhood. And again, I can't blame somebody who was never given the love that they deserved, because how do they then learn to give that to their son?
Mm-hmm. Speaking of son, you talked about the writer, you talked about the director. Talk about your son. Talk about this actor who plays this boy. Because
well, I have three sons, really.
Actually, that's true. Tell me about the three chapters and the three males.
Well, we have the wonderful Alex Hibbert, who was 11 years old, who has never acted before, but you would never believe it when you see him. He's an extraordinary performer, and he has this incredible lightness of being, but you'd never know that from watching, you know, him on screen, because he seems so sad and depressed and, you know, the way he's shot. But actually, in between takes, he'd do his little Michael Jackson impersonations.
And you're a big Michael Jackson fan.
I'm a big Michael Jackson fan. So when you get him singing Ben, oh, my gosh, it brings a tear to your eye. Like Michael Jackson's, you know, been reborn. It's amazing. So he was wonderful to work with. But it was such a strange experience because normally you would spend a lot of time getting to know child actors, you know, building up this rapport.
Right.
And because I only shot this in 3 days,
I want to come back to that.
That's all I had.
Yeah, yeah.
So there was no time to build up any rapport. I just kind of had to jump into it and, you know, make sure that the actors were willing to play with me and to be vulnerable with me. And I was just really lucky that every single one of them was. Like Trevante Rhodes, who plays my eldest son, Black, I met him 10 minutes before we did the final emotional scene at the end of the movie where I ask for his forgiveness.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
You're the only person, as I recall, the only actor who's in all three of those chapters.
Yeah.
Is that a special, is there a pressure to that? Is there a burden when you're the only person? You're the through line here in all three of these chapters.
For me, I find it a joy because, you know, I was able to create this full arc for my character and flesh that out. There are massive chunks of time which are not in the actual film. Mm-hmm. And so I had to fill those in for myself and use my imagination to wonder at what has happened to this character, you know, at these various stages in her life. Because, you know, she makes a massive transition to the worst possible place. From when you see her in the start to the second chapter, she's in a really awful place. So kind of asking those really interesting questions about how did this happen, you know, how did she end up in that state? That was a fascinating journey for me. I loved it.
Yeah. So I'm curious, actually, set your modesty aside just for a second here.
Okay.
How does one, I mean, you've done 1,000 projects, and most of them were not shot over 3 days.
No.
You've had a whole lot, you've had many, you know, massively bigger, larger budgets to work with for the production. So you do a film that you shoot in 3 days.
Yeah.
You're the only person in all three chapters. Mm-hmm. You meet some of the actors 10 minutes before you actually film this thing.
Yes.
And it ends up being the project that everybody's talking about. it's going to be on the Oscar list, I think, pretty, I'm pretty sure of that. I mean, everybody's talking about this. How do you square? I'm thinking about a line that I heard many years ago, which says that we plan and God laughs.
Yes.
We plan our lives in certain ways, but there's so many things that we can't control. Mm-hmm. So what do you make of the fact that you spent all this time prepping for these other films? The little film you shot in 3 days is the one that everybody's buzzing about.
Do you know what? Though all of those films that I've worked on over the years gave me the arsenal and the expertise to be able to jump in here and do this role in only 3 days.
Right.
Without that history, I would never have been able to do this.
Yeah.
So it all helps.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, you know, it wasn't, you know, it's 3 days that I shot it in, but it's a month of preparation I spent finding out this character. And I think it's the most research I've done for any character because, as we talked about before, it's the one that's most alien to me.
So this business is clearly about entertainment, no doubt about that, and no apologies for that. It's Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there are times in one's career, if they're fortunate, where they get a chance to not just entertain, but to empower as well, because the film is telling a story that can empower, enlighten, you know, encourage, uplift the rest, inspire the rest of us. So how do you go about making your choices about what you want to do? Because this film clearly has, it's textured and layered with so many messages in it.
You start off by what moves you, you know, and what you emotionally connect to. And if you feel after reading the script that you're edified, you know, you're changed as a person, then you realize it's going to do the same for an audience, you know, and that's the kind of project that you want to be part of. You know, you choose projects for different reasons, though, for sure. But this one definitely was, you know, I just thought it was so special and it has such a beautiful message about tolerance and understanding and acceptance. And it's so interesting that that's why I wanted to be part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had to go on that same journey myself. It wasn't until I learned understanding and acceptance of Paula that she could really reveal herself to me as a character.
Yeah. You've answered this question to some degree, but let me ask it a different way because I might get a different answer or you might expand on it or expound upon it. So the question simply is, what did you learn about yourself doing this project? Every actor, I think, learns something about themselves, about the world they live in when they do a project. What did you learn about Naomi Harris when you did this project?
That I'm very, very fortunate.
Yeah.
that, you know, the reason why I, you know, thought that I was so different from Paula is simply because of life circumstances, yeah. you know. Yeah. And if my life circumstances had been different, I probably would have ended up making the same choices that Paula has made. Mm. And that's why it's so important not to stand in judgment of other people, because we don't know what path they have led, you know, what path they have trodden. And your life circumstances are what really make you, you know, who you are.
Yeah. Speaking of life circumstances, let me shift just a bit. How did this end up being your calling, your vocation, this acting thing?
I don't know. Yeah. I really don't know because, you know, I would tell people when I was 4 years old, I'm going to be an actress. Mm. And I don't know where that came from because no one in my family at the time was in acting. Mm-hmm. In fact, everyone told me, how are you going to make a living out of being an actress? Mm. You know, nobody makes a living out of being an actress. But I just had this belief, and I would stand in front of the mirror as a child trying to make myself cry, imagining I was different people. Mm-hmm. My granddad at the time gave me like a children's version of the Bible. Mm-hmm. And I would hold people hostage in our sitting room and just like read to them from the Bible. Still to this day, I don't know where it comes from.
Yeah. When did you know that you were good enough to tell your family, I am making a living from doing this?
I don't know whether that day has ever come.
Oh, no, you're there
still,
now.
I'm still waiting for
No. You're a Bond girl, so you arrive.
No, I think when you can do nice things for your family, like take them on holiday, you know, and treat your mom, and, you know, that's a wonderful feeling.
Yeah. I know that feeling. Mm. Yeah, I know that. So all my friends know I'm a huge James Bond fan. Mm-hmm. So when I saw you pop up on screen in the Bond films, I was like, wow, how cool is this? That's just me watching you on screen, but how cool was it for you to be in a couple Bond films?
It was fantastic. Yeah. I never thought that I was going to be in a Bond movie ever. In fact, when they asked me to audition, I thought it was a joke because I know that they audition like thousands of people all around the world. So I just thought, I'm there making up the numbers. They're never going to choose me. And then when I got down to the final three, Sam Mendes says, you know, there's only two other actresses that we're thinking about. And I was like, this is serious? Yeah. Really? Me? I couldn't believe it. But I thought I was auditioning for the part of a Bond girl. Yeah. And then they revealed to me that actually I was, you know, auditioning for Miss Moneypenny.
And that's the part that got me. It's like, you're not just playing any character. Yeah. You're playing
a recurring
one. Exactly. And that is recurring. I mean, there's only one Moneypenny.
Yes.
I mean, it was amazing to see you to play that.
It's wonderful. And also to have the privilege of being able to make her whatever I wanted her to be, you know?
Yeah.
That was a wonderful
thing. So what happens to one's career when you do a couple Bond films?
It changes.
Yeah, tell me
yeah,
how. Tell me
it
how.
Does yeah. change it. Well, I think I was very, very lucky up until that point because I was able to be a working actress without being recognized on the street and just kind of live my everyday life. I'm a very private person, really. So I was able to, you know, walk that fine line and balance things really well. But Bond changes all of that and suddenly you become much more visible. Yeah. And, you know, that's a difficult transition.
Yeah. yeah. So Bond is iconic.
Mm-hmm.
So is Winnie Mandela.
Yes.
How do you process, as a part of your corpus now, your body of work, you have played Winnie Mandela?
I just love the fact that I've had that challenge because it was a huge challenge. And you know, the thing that I'm most proud about is that Winnie actually saw you know, the performance that I gave.
I was gonna ask what she thought about it,
And she said, you know, that's the first time that I've been represented on screen. And I just felt like that was such a huge honor. Mm-hmm. And the reason why it's such a huge honor for me is because I actually sat down with her before I took on the role. And I said to her, Winnie, there are such opposing views about who you are. Some people paint you as a devil, some people as a saint. Where do you see yourself? And she said, Naomi, you've been given this role. Just play it as you see fit. I'm not going to tell you how I see myself. And so she basically allowed me to interpret her as I saw fit, which is an incredible honor.
It also feels like pressure, though, too.
No, it felt like less pressure because, you know, she said to me, I want you to play me as the saint, you know, and I'm the hero and, you know, none of this villain stuff. Then it would have been much harder to find her because the truth is she sits somewhere in the middle. But to have someone who's humble enough to say, tell the truth about who I am. Portray me as you see fit was incredibly liberating. And then when she finally saw it and she said, you know, you did your research and you got me.
I'll put you on the spot here. What did you learn about yourself playing that character in that particular film? Because she's
Do you know, not nice things in terms of there is so much hatred. Winnie's story is fueled by so much hatred, mm-hmm. actually. And when you really explore the brutality of apartheid, mm-hmm. you understand why. And living in that context of such brutality and hatred doesn't make you, it doesn't do very nice things to you as a human being. Mm-hmm. And I found that really hard, actually, to leave her skin after I'd played her for the 3 months that I'd been in her body. You know, she was, with Paula, with Moonlight, it was very easy after those 3 days. I just felt like I'd exercised her and I could walk away. Mm-hmm. With Winnie, she stayed with me for a good 6 months after mm-hmm. filming.
How'd you get past it?
I don't know, just life, you know, and the beauty of life, and reminding myself of the beauty of life, and also that just being incredibly lucky that we don't live in those times.
Yeah, yeah. Tell me more about your journey, because again, we stateside know who mm-hmm. you are now that you've hit these Bond films, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But tell me more about what your journey was like in the UK, getting to this place. Well, your journey as an actor, yeah.
Well, I've been working since I was 9 years old. And I was very lucky as a child because I worked basically, I was only allowed to work during my summer holidays, mm-hmm. and I worked every single summer holiday. So I would do these children's TV shows.
Right.
I then took a break and I went to Cambridge and I studied mm-hmm. social and political sciences. And then
wow.
after that, yes, yeah. something's very, very different. Yeah. I had a really inspirational teacher called Mr. Murdoch, and he said, I think you can go to Oxbridge and I'm going to help you. And yeah. he did. And it just shows the power wow. of one great teacher who yeah. believes in you can transform mm-hmm. your life. So that's why I ended up at Cambridge. But I still had this burning passion for acting. And so I went to drama school after Cambridge, and yeah. I went to the Bristol Vic Theatre School. And I trained for 2 years, and then I came out. And the first role I got was 28 Days Later.
Yeah.
And that was the start of everything.
Yeah. Tell me about your friendship with Danny Boyle.
Oh, I love Danny Boyle.
Yeah.
You know, I really do. I really credit him. Well, he was the first person. You know, when you're starting your career, you always need that one person mm-hmm. who's going to take a risk on you. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really have very many credits. You know, I'd been at university, then I'd been at drama schools. I hadn't been working for a long time. And, you know, he gave me the co-lead in this big movie of his mm-hmm. and he has always championed me and believed in me, and he did that then, and then he did it, like, I think it was about 10 years later when I did Frankenstein at the National, and I hadn't done theatre mm-hmm. since leaving drama school, and he gave me this part of Elizabeth Lavenza in Frankenstein at the National in front of 1,100 mm-hmm. people every night, and that's how I got Bond, because yeah. Sam Mendes was in the audience.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. You love theatre enough to do more of it?
No.
Not yet, really?
To be totally honest with you,
yeah.
No. I mean, I get really bad stage fright.
Yeah.
And I used to feel like I was going to throw up before going on stage every single night. And I used to think, it'll get better, it'll yeah. get better. And it never did.
Yeah.
And I think...
Is it the live audience?
It's the live audience. It's the fact that you can't say stop. Oh, yeah. My God, I made a mistake. Let's go back.
Yeah.
You know, as you can right. do in film, you know.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, you haven't quite hit it.
Yeah.
And that's, for me, is so frustrating, that feeling of knowing that an audience has gone away and I feel like I haven't given them my best possible performance.
Yeah.
And I love the fact in film that you can go back time and time again until you think,
right.
I've got it right.
Yeah, yeah. I want to go back, speaking of getting it right, I don't want this to end without going back to get this right.
Yeah.
But I was fascinated by what you said, that you were scared mm-hmm. that you wouldn't get Paula right mm-hmm. in Moonlight.
Yes.
And yet it was the conquering of the fear that brought such a beautiful performance. Mm-hmm. Do you not feel that way on other roles that you accept, that this vulnerability about whether or not you can actually get it right?
Yeah.
You feel that consistently? Or
I feel that every time
okay,
I get a role.
Okay, yeah.
Every single time I get a role,
right.
I always think, oh my gosh, I can't do it. Mm-hmm. Oh gosh, you know. But usually they come easier than
yeah,
Paula.
Yeah.
It doesn't
yeah.
take as long. Paula was a real process to yeah. find. But I think that's what you want as a performer. Mm-hmm. You want to be scared. You want to feel like, oh my gosh, I can't reach this, because then mm-hmm. you're really pushing yourself outside of your comfort zone. And that's
yeah.
when you truly grow and find things within yourself that you didn't know
yeah.
were there. Because I don't think that characters are imposed from the outside in.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're all within you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a journey that you have to go on to find something mm-hmm. within yourself that you didn't know was there. And then you exercise it, you bring it to the light, and you grow and become a better person because of it. And mm-hmm. that's why I love acting.
Yeah. Naomi, an honor to have you on. Thank you for your
Thank
time.
Thank you.
Good
Thank
to
you
have
so
you
much.
Here. You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS.
For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel Nsi Abuadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.